Welcome everyone to S3, the Science, Sex and Sorcery podcast, where twice a month we'll be bringing you news, reviews, recommendations and deeper discussion from the worlds of science fiction, romance and fantasy. I'm Terence McManus and I'm an indie SFF writer.
And I'm Belinda Misson, a romance writer published by HarperCollins.
This podcast exists because Belinda and I realised that since we were already wasting a bunch of the time we should have been writing, talking about books and movies on the internet instead, we might as well put those discussions to good use.
And coming from varying writing backgrounds, one of us from podcasting and self-publishing, and the other from self-publishing and traditional, it kind of allows us to bring unique perspectives and experience to each book that we choose. We'll be releasing podcasts twice a month, reviewing a new book each time and giving you our insights to the stories and news items across the publishing world. Now, speaking of news, this week has been brimming with gossip from the world of publishing. I was excited to see that over at my own publisher, HarperCollins, B.A. Paris has a new book on the way. She's one for the thriller lovers out there. But in terms of romance, which is me, there are some great new releases from Katie Ginger, whose book Summer Season on the Seafront was a great slice of escapism into the world of local theatre. It's a follow-up to her previous book, which was The Little Theatre on the Seafront, but they're both perfectly readable as standalone books. My review will be going up on website and social media shortly. And Terry, have you got any fantasy or science fiction news you'd like to share?
Well, it's getting a little long in the tooth as a news item now, but a couple of weeks ago, we had the winners of the DITMARS, which is the longest running of the Australian Spec Fic Awards, announced at the Continuum Convention in Melbourne. Standouts from that included City of Lies by Sam Hawke, which won Best Novel, and Cabaret of Monsters by Tansy Rayner Roberts, which won Best Novelette. Rather than go through the rest of the list, we might just put a link to the full list of nominees and winners in the show notes, so you can check them out and you might even find your next favourite Aussie read there. But without further ado, let's go on and talk about the book we've chosen to review this month, which is The Black God's Drums by P. Jelly Clark.
So for readers who aren't familiar with this book, and I certainly wasn't before you brought it to my attention, the Amazon blurb is as follows. In an alternate New Orleans caught in the tangle of the American Civil War, the wall-scaling girl named Creeper yearns to escape the streets for the air, in particular by earning a spot on board the airship Midnight Robber, which I just think is a really cool name. Creeper plans to earn Captain Anne Marie's trust with information she discovers about a Haitian scientist and a mysterious weapon he calls the Black God's Drums. But Creeper also has a secret herself. Oya, and I hope I pronounced that right, the African Orisha of the Wind and Storms speaks inside her head and may have her own ulterior motives. Soon, Creeper, Oya, and the crew of the Midnight Rubber are pulled into a perilous mission aimed to stop the Black God's Drums from being unleashed and wiping out the entirety of New Orleans. I think at this point it's worth noting that this book was a Hugo Award nominee for Best Novella in 2019, a Nebula Award nominee for Best Novella in 2018, a Locus Award nominee for novella in 2019, and the ALA Alex Award winner in 2019. So it's clearly got some clout behind it as it heads off into the world. I know it's been a few weeks since we both read this, Terry, and we did talk a lot about it at the time, a lot. Could you fill me in on your first thoughts immediately after finishing post-rollercoaster? How did you feel?
Yeah, it's had a little while to settle now, hasn't it? But to be honest, immediately after I put the book down, my opinion on it was pretty mixed. On the one hand, I felt it had a lot going for it, especially the world building, setting and the characters and the way that the magic system was integrated sort of into both of those aspects. But at the same time, I did feel like a lot of those things weren't really explored as deeply as I'd have liked them, particularly when it all came together at the ending, which I did feel was a little bit rushed, even though it was still very satisfying. I love the writing style and the language in this, especially how different it is to what I usually read and the fiction that I mainly focus on through fantasy and science fiction. But that language did leave my head swimming a little bit in places too. And I'm sure we'll get into a discussion on some of those elements in a moment. But overall, I'd have to say my first impressions were positive. And obviously the big grab sack of award nominations that an award winner status that this novelette has got really shows that it does have a real strength to it in all those elements. What were your first impressions, Belinda?
Okay, so this was really different for me. As you know, I come from the background of chick lit and romance, so there's not a whole lot of airships or, you know, African gods going on in there. But that was part of the reason I jumped at this podcast and this book in particular, was I need to broaden my reading habits. So my initial thoughts on this were, quite like you, I was pleasantly surprised. I loved the world building. I got a really futuristic Jules Verne vibe from a lot of it. I could picture lots of brass, lots of journey to the center of the earth, the old school submarines, which, I mean, submarines have got absolutely nothing to do with the story anyway, but the streets and the alleyways made me think of a metro station in France that is fashioned to look like it's come out of a Jules Verne novel. But I did also love the mashup of the elements. So we've got the book set in the late 1800s New Orleans, but we've also got airships and flight, which is kind of contrasted with a brothel that takes me back to Saturday afternoon movies on steamboats with big dresses and John Wayne and card games. So it was all sort of, it was very busy and happening, but it was a really nice mix, I thought. And a new element for me was the magic, which I think we discussed at the time, and you referred to it as something called magic realism.
Yeah, look, basically, I thought it qualified for that. For those who aren't familiar, magical like realism is a kind of a way of approaching fantasy where that magic is just part of the real natural world. So the writer doesn't pay the kind of attention to it that you get in a more traditional high fantasy kind of setting. Because of that, it often comes across as a little more sort of chaotic because it's not a centerpiece in the story. You don't get that, I'm going to sit you down and we're going to talk about how the magic system works scene in the story. It's just there in the background. The characters don't take the time to explain it because, well, it's like, you know, gravity. Everyone knows what it is and how it works. It's not the same as saying that there are no rules to the magic system. There are, but the writer's focusing more on what the results of magic being present in the story are rather than sort of the wonder of that magic being present in the story at all, if that makes sense.
Makes total sense. And it means that you're not getting bogged down with, like you said, sit down and let me explain everything to you. It just, the story happens and the magic's part of it and you just deal with it. And hearing you explain it like that makes a lot more sense to me as someone who doesn't read that genre, because this is where we learned that my approach is from the romance genre. We don't get a lot of magic, or not in any of the fiction that I've read, but I really enjoyed that approach too. The story didn't lag and we didn't get held up. And I loved that it was in there, that it's happening. And it's just, like you said, it's a usual part of the story. We don't get the folklore or the story history. And I feel that adds to the authenticity. It's just there. So you deal with it.
Yeah, there's no sort of, you know, 10,000 years ago, the might of men and elves fought against Sauron in the prologue or anything here. It just makes it really visible. The magic is really visible in the world building rather than sort of being set up as a set piece. And there's so much world building packed into such a small space here that these constant reminders of the world is different because of the magic system. You know, simple things like that fact that these African gods exist, this voodoo magic is real and exists. I mean, that plays a big part in how the American slave trade plays out in this world. You know, those gods are just looking at these Europeans coming in to try to steal people and they're just going, no, you don't. And ultimately that sort of, you know, it leads to these really different set pieces, like the way that New Orleans as a city is structured in the way that America is structured in this world, and ultimately, you know, leading around to the Black God's drums, the magical super weapon, which works as the title in the book.
Exactly. And I love that so much. And I'd love to see more alternate history from this author for exactly those reasons. Like if they delved into the slave trade and, you know, just moved around different parts of America at the time. And another element that I loved about this book was an unapologetically strong female. I also don't remember any point in the book where we had any characters that were taken aback by that. So I find that, like, I was watching an episode of Victoria this morning, which is about Queen Victoria and how she came to be. And she comes off straight off the bat as a very strong character, but she's got men all around her saying, you know, you can't do this and you can't do that. And they're always chastising her for being strong and very unapologetic about what she wants. But in this book, we don't suffer from any of that. We had Creeper, we had Anne-Marie. They were both quite certain and strong and go-getting in their own fields. And it didn't seem to be a drama in this world. But I know that you had some initial thoughts on this too.
Yeah, look, it's a minor gripe, really, and it's probably only really visible to me because, sort of like you, seeing similarities in other media. I sort of came, I've come across this exact same plot point in the last three books that I've read, where you're starting out with this, you know, sort of pointless sleight of hand. We're introduced here to the story through Creeper's perspective, you know, and we're carefully not given any gender cues in the writing. It's very, that's very deliberate for the first sort of chapter. And then the moment that they go into the brothel, Creeper is treated as though they're a young boy by one of the clientele. But then, we get surprised, everyone. Creeper is actually a girl.
And it's funny that you mention that, because I did go back and read the first little bit of the book, because I'm like, can't work out if we've got a girl or a boy. And I know that, you know, it shouldn't determine the enjoyment of the book, but I kind of like to picture the people in my head as I go along. So yeah. I did pick up that there was some genderless writing going on.
Yeah. And look, it is just, that little bit frustrating, because it doesn't really seem to add anything to the story except just trying to give that sort of gotcha moment to the reader. Because like you say, for the rest of the book, we've got all these, this parade of strong female characters who are just operating in this world, and it's not made a big thing of. So I don't really get why we have to have Creeper sort of sneaking around pretending to be a boy at the start, when all the world seems to be built around the fact that it doesn't really matter. These women have got just as much impetus to succeed as a male does. So why do we have it? It's so natural through the rest of the story. Like you say, it's easy not to notice that all of the other characters in the story are female, except the antagonists. Everyone they run into in a position of power in this book is a female.
Yeah, and I'd have to agree with you on that. And I mean, I wonder if I missed something in the book that explained why we got the sleight of hand. Maybe I missed something, maybe I didn't. I really love seeing just women come out of the gate and here's what I'm at and here's what I'm about and I'm going to go and kick your ass for it. I want to say that perhaps women and girls weren't taken as seriously in that world, sort of in that late 1800s period, as is so often the case. But again, the steamboat, the brothel scene, which is not a steamboat, I have to correct that because it just reminds me of the old steamboat films, but it left me with the sense that women were mostly in control in this world. So, you know, I would have to agree with you there that I don't sort of understand why that happened. And from my experience I write contemporary romance set in modern times and days, so the worlds are a little different, but I just feel like when I'm edited, you know, we're looking for strong women. We want, you know, they've got their goals, they need to go and achieve it. They've got the roadblocks like, you know, every other character in fiction. And we can talk about, you know, their faults and insecurities. So maybe perhaps a bit of internal dialogue what might have explained why Creeper was disguised, if that makes sense. But again, like, this was only a really tiny part of the book. I feel like we've spent a bit of time on it, but it doesn't detract from the story at all. I think we've just gone on about it because we're both a bit fascinated by the fact that it happened.
Yeah, I don't want to say like we're ragging on the book for this here either. I mean, it is a pretty nitpicky point. But at the same time, I do feel that if something so small is the worst we can say about this book, I mean, I think that gives a pretty good idea of the overall quality of the rest of this story. And I'll absolutely second that call you made earlier for really wanting to see some more alternate history from this author, especially set in this world. And I kind of got the feeling that that is what this book was aiming to do. There's a lot of elements in here that look like they're setting things up. They're sort of setting a stage through this story, and I'd love to see when they return to this stage to actually sort of put on the play in a full-length novel or a series.
Yeah, it definitely looked like that. Like, I got to the end and I thought, oh, I feel like there needs to be more. I need to read more of this.
Well, without getting too spoilery, actually, we've talked a bit about the world building and a bit about sort of, I guess, the character of the story and the characters in the story. But like you say, sort of heading towards the ending there, what did you think about the narrative itself, so the way it was constructed and presented?
So that was a bit of a treat. And I'm approaching it from someone who has, I've spent the last few years sort of studying, writing and getting diplomas and learning my craft and putting together all the spelling and the grammar and the so-called correct ways in which language should be used in the written prose. And then this book comes along and just tosses it all out the window. So the narrative, the style of writing is very much like having a conversation with the main character or, you know, anyone with an accent. You get the nuances, you get the slang that sometimes it takes you a little bit to pick up, and it can take some time to get used to the dialogue that Creeper uses. And I think we both had a little bit of trouble with that to begin with. It's a little casual, but it's very much in keeping with the vibe of the late 1800s New Orleans, which you know, what I do love about that is seeing such a different voice. And I think they refer to his own voices in literature. It makes for a really refreshing change after lots of the same, must use the language correctly, you know, full stops, commas, and use your proper English words. And I think bringing this stuff out into the world will open up all these different stories and techniques going forward to really change the way that literature is delivered. And I know that this, for us, was a big talking point because we were sort of trying to get used to the slang, but we were enjoying it, but it was also a little bit jarring because of that reason. What did you think?
Yeah, look, I think that pretty much sums it up, really. It is a treat to read, but you're right. It's a treat once you get used to it. It is a real head spin trying to really narrow down on what these slang terms mean and how you're, you know, internally meant to read the language as you're reading along. I did find actually at one point I had to sort of say a couple of paragraphs out loud to try to get my tongue around what was going on and how Creeper was talking and thinking. Once I did, I really liked the way that narrative style, like you say, sort of that conversational aspect to it. I did like the way that that progressed the narrative through the story. And, you know, it paces out the plot sort of a bit by bit because you're not learning everything all at once because, again, the main character with that sort of magical realism tint to it. The main character, you know, understands what's going on and how it works. So they don't really need to internally monologue to themselves what's going on. They just sort of get on and do it. And
yeah,
you know, as you get through it, building it up towards the end, I did enjoy as well how that all comes together.
I'm thinking about it now. It kind of feels like you're the little orange man in Google Maps and you've just been dropped into the story and you've got to run with it.
Yeah, exactly.
You're running alongside Creeper and she's explaining to you what's going on and you've just got to keep up. And too bad for you if you can't.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's kind of like the only real trouble with it was it's kind of a short trip too, you know. It suffers a little from the constraint of the word count. But what was done with that amount of words is phenomenal. And it was really pretty satisfying, even with all that in mind. And look, I'm really itching to see what this kind of storytelling is. If it was given its full room to move, you know, if we had the 2-hour trip instead of the 20-minute commute on that Google map.
Oh, there could have been some fabulous stuff happening had we had the room for the word count. But, you know, having said that, I'm in the middle of writing a novella, just got my first draft back, and it's just so hard to get that right balance between story, world building, descriptors, getting enough information in and out and around. So I think what has been done has been really well done.
You know, I reckon that sounds like a really good place to leave the Black Gods drums for today. At the end of all that, I mean, I think we can probably both recommend this as a read, yeah?
Definitely. It feels like a great book for people who aren't entirely sure on sci-fi fantasy. And I mean, admittedly, it's been a long time between Drinks for Me and science fiction. I think my last sci-fi read was 2015, like Andy Weir's The Martian. And before that, it was Tracy Harding's Ancient Future trilogy, which was probably in my late teens, early 20s. So I'm really glad that we picked this as our first book. It wasn't too heavy or chewy. It was straight in a great story. And I know that you've already read next month's book, so I'm going to look forward to digging into that just as soon as I finish what I'm reading at the moment, which is a little bit of a Christmas romance called Snowy Nights at the Lonely Hearts Hotel. How about you? What are you reading?
Well, I'm actually hopping from the Black Gods drums over to another alternate history story by trading in the fantasy for science fiction. I've got Mary Robinette Cowell's The Calculating Stars very patiently sitting on my iBooks library waiting to be read. And keeping on that theme too, next time on the Science, Sex and Sorcery podcast, we're going to go full sci-fi with a little bit of romance thrown in to sweeten the deal. We'll be trading steampunk airships this time for high-tech spaceships when we look at Across the Void by S.K. Vaughan. Now, if you want to get in on that action the moment that it drops, you can subscribe to the podcast through Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and most of the other places that you can get your podcasts online. You can also listen to the podcast and find updates on our website, www.s3pod.com. That's 3 the number, not 3 the word. And stay tuned. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Bye.